Well, if you're tired of spending hours on cardio with minimal results, then listen up because I got a game-changing fitness breakthrough for you. The Carol Bike, science-backed, time-saving solution trusted by experts for optimizing health and longevity. They use this special form of a workout called a Rehit, which allows you to achieve superior health and fitness benefits compared to regular cardio in 90% less time. That's amazing. That's a lot of time, 90%. Studies show that by doing Carol's five-minute workout just three times a week, you can improve your fitness by 12%, reduce your risk of type 2 diabetes by 62%, and even wind back your internal body clock by 10 years. The science is clear. Carol Bike is your ticket to a healthier and more vibrant life. You got to try it to believe it and to see what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like a walk in the park. When you're pushing hard in those intervals, you're pushing, but then it's just like over and it's done and it walks you through it. It's very motivating. It's 5 feet away from me right now. It's right here in my office, my cool little exercise toy in my office. So you get $250 off your Carol Bike. You don't have to wait any longer. You can join over 25,000 riders and visit carolbike.com today. Carolbike.com. Well, if you're like me, you live a busy life. You don't really have time for many days off. That's why I talk so much about your mitochondria, because they generate about 90% of the energy your body uses. And keeping your mitochondria strong is one of the best ways to keep fatigue at bay. But these little mitochondria, darn things, are expensive to run. They use a huge amount of raw materials, especially when it comes to minerals. The problem is most people, including you and me, probably don't get enough minerals. And without minerals, your mitochondria don't have the cofactors they need to make energy. More than 97% of Americans don't get enough potassium. About 80% are deficient in magnesium. 40% are deficient in calcium. And those are three of the big ones. There's close to a dozen other trace minerals that are important for mitochondrial function, and most of us don't get enough of them, and you definitely can't get them from, say, table salt. It turns out that trying to take all the minerals you need by taking single mineral supplements isn't only hard because you need a ton of pills, but it's not the most effective way to get your minerals. That's why I take liquid, humic, and fulvic complexes. These are full spectrum mineral supplements, which means you get all the essential minerals your body needs in one go without a daily handful of massive amounts of pills or very large capsules or anything else that's hard to swallow. I use Beam mineral supplements because they're almost 100% bioavailable. They come in a liquid form that's easy to drink. It's just two bottles. I keep them in my pantry, throw back a shot a few times a day. They're a great way to refill your mineral stores, especially for those of you out here who are haunting your sauna on a frequent basis, or sweating, or doing hot yoga, or anything else. Keep your mitochondria running strong. So if you want to up your mineral game, give Beam Minerals a try. Go to Beam Minerals, B-E-A-M, minerals.com, and use code BEN at checkout for 20% off your first order. In this episode of the Ben Greenfield Fitness Show.
It's just when you live in the woods a couple hundred days a year, you're going to fall in a river from time to time. You're going to be forced to put your body through things that they're not used to.
Survival is a perishable skill. Other than the will to live, that's ingrained in people, or it's not. A lot of these skills, obviously, I practice whether I need to or not now, which is why it's pretty hard for me to get too worried about any survival situation.
It is an art form to be able to take someone's body from a perspective of where you're at. You can take someone and form them with dedication and hard work into who they want to be.
He's an expert in human performance and nutrition. Voted America's top personal trainer and one of the globe's most influential people in health and fitness. His show provides you with everything you need to optimize physical and mental performance. He is Ben Greenfield.
Power. Speed. Mobility. Balance. Whatever it is for you, that's the natural movement. Get out there. When you look at all the studies done, studies that have shown the greatest efficacy.
All the information you need in one place, right here, right now, on the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast.
Hey folks, it's Ben Greenfield here, and my guest today is a guy named Aaron Snyder. You may have heard of Aaron before. He's actually a frequent guest on one of the top-ranked outdoors podcasts in iTunes called The Gritty Bowman. And Aaron is actually a man of quite a few hats. He's a former military man, a search and rescue team member, former MMA fighter. He's the current knowledge guru
at an outdoors gear company, which is actually how I met him, an outdoors gear company called Kifaru. And they make things like packs and tents and things that allow you to survive in the backcountry. And Aaron has a pretty cool approach because he's not only super fit and takes his physical training pretty seriously, and you'll get a chance to dig into what he does for his own physical regimen during today's podcast episode, but he also helps men and women all over the globe get ready for everything from wilderness survival to epic backpacking trips to some of the most difficult hunts on the face of the planet. So he really knows his way around the outdoors. He's also a photographer. He's a freelance writer. He's a pretty hardcore, tough guy who knows a lot about how to make a backpack fit right, which I've had to talk with him quite a bit about in my own train to hunt competing. He knows a lot about surviving in harsh conditions. He knows how to take some pretty epic photographs of nature, how to hunt big animals, and a lot more. He's one of the most entertaining and knowledgeable guys you're ever going to meet when it comes to everything outdoors. So, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thanks. I appreciate it. I'm happy to be on here. You may have made me sound a little bit better, or a lot better than I actually am.
No worries, man. I know you had the video turned on before we actually started recording today's episode, and it did appear that you were actually drinking pink Kool-Aid. So I do know you have a feminine side as well.
My daughter, she's a Kool-Aid drinker. I join in with her.
Got it. Although you admitted it, what was some kind of a protein concoction or something like that?
Yeah, a recovery drink. You know how that goes. Yep.
So why were you drinking a recovery drink this time of the morning?
We did a 6-mile loop with an insane amount of weight last night in preparation for a race we have coming up. And where I'm at here with Red Rocks being here, we're very, very blessed being able to beat our bodies up with some extreme training areas, Red Rocks being probably number one for just a killer. And we did 3 miles, and then we did loops around Red Rocks Amphitheater, the bleachers.
And that's in Colorado, right?
Yep, in Colorado. We're in Wheat Ridge. Kifaru International's in Wheat Ridge, but the Red Rocks is just down the road. It's right by my house. And it's a good place if you want to feel like go in the pain cave for a couple hours, throw 50 pounds, 60 pounds on your back, climb up the bleachers, you'll hit the pain cave quick.
Is that what you guys were doing, 50, 60-pound pack racing, basically?
We had 65 pounds. We wanted to stay. We try to stay at a 4-mile-per-hour pace, give or take, until we get to the bleachers or the stairs. Then those, obviously, we just try to, you know, literally make it to the top without stopping. No set pace other than, obviously, we're men and we're competitive. The guys that do this, it's mostly men. And so no one wants to be the last dude up. So the only pace being set is the guy in front. There's not actually technically timed pace. But get a bunch of guys together, you're probably going to end up, you know, passing out trying to stay in the front.
And what's this race you're training for?
It's Mountain Ops Kifaru. Well, basically it's going to be more of a road march. You in for 5 miles with 40 pounds, back out for 5 miles with 80. And then there's a archery and a rifle competition the next day. It's a buddy team event. And it was more catered towards what I did in the military on the road march side with, you know, a little bit of a twist, obviously. But for me, when you backpack hunt, you're going in with relatively lightweight. Obviously, the end goal is to put something on the ground, and you're coming out with heavyweight. So that's why the whole five in, five out, lightweight going in and heavyweight coming out.
Is somebody just like at the other end, like putting an extra 40 pounds down that you guys put into your packs and return with?
Exactly. There's weigh stations as well, just to check, obviously, you know, keep the honest people honest. There's weigh stations in the middle as well as the end. And then, you know, the sandbags is basically, it's going to be 40, and then you just drop another 40, and then your water weight does not count. The water weight is above and beyond the 40 and the 80 pounds.
Gotcha. That sounds a little bit like the train to hunt nationals competition that they had in Colorado last year. I remember sucking wind during that thing because it was at elevation, but what they did was you had an obstacle course and you were wearing about, I believe it was 40 or 50 pounds in your pack during the obstacle course, where you'd do everything from burpees to balancing on logs to sandbag get ups with that weight on your back. And every time you'd get to a specific obstacle, you would have to shoot, right? You'd have to demonstrate that you could shoot while you were gassed. But then at the very end of that, you had your backpack waiting with 100 more pounds loaded on it. And there was like this mile and a half long crucible at the very end of the obstacle course where you just had to put on that pack and go as fast as possible to the finish line. So these kind of races are a ton of fun. I think they're exploding in popularity. I don't know what you're seeing on your end, but it seems like folks are getting more and more into this, this whole like, real world esque competition that actually has some practical implications for things like backpacking and wilderness survival.
No, I agree. And we're definitely seeing it on our end. And like anything, you get, you can get haters, right? People that you don't need to be fit to hunt, or you don't wait. But in the grand scheme of things, it's always better. You're always a better person if you're more fit or you are fit in general. It also gives a much better look at hunters. I mean, I've noticed anti-hunters or even people mid-road when they actually say, oh, these guys train and these guys, for a hunter, you know, a lot of people look at us as blasting animals out the side of, out of a window, right? Out of the side of the road, where in my case, we'll go for 8, 10, 12, 14 days at a time living off our back. And it takes a lot of physical and mental prep to be able to do that. And I think it the fitness aspect of hunting puts a whole new look on hunting in general and a much better look to me. And I think the changes in these races and everything are very good for the sport.
Oh, yeah. And obviously, it goes above and beyond hunting. Like, I was recently in Kauai, Hawaii, and we weren't doing any hunting over there, but we were just trekking. You know, we had some days where we'd do 8 miles. We had some days where we'd do 22 miles. And all of the skills that I've had to develop, just learning how to say, you know, pack a backpack right, which I actually want to talk to you a little bit about in today's podcast, and how, you know, how to fit a pack, how to pack a pack, and then how to go for long periods of time with everything from your boots to your pack set up properly. I mean, that stuff comes in handy for everything from, you know, not just hunting to just, you know, seeing more of the world while you're out there and being able to go for longer periods of time without having to stop at a, you know, at a hotel or a grocery store just because you're self-sustainable.
Right. You know, you're right. And I mean, it goes, like you say, it does go into much, much more than hunting or even backpacking in general. And I think the, not to see a squirrel and go off on a tangent, the idea of a lot of people, including myself, is hard to break away from the, oh, we're on the way back from, you know, doing whatever. Let's stop at the gas station and grab a protein bar, or let's go out to dinner, where my lifestyle, and I'm sure as well as yours, pre-prepping food. I carry an isobutane, a stove in my car. One, it saves money, but two, is it that big of a deal for me to just heat up my food that I've pre-made and it's free, then stop and eat a relatively unhealthy meal at a restaurant that I don't know really what's in it. I don't know the sodium content, and I don't know what else has gone into that, where I've made my own food out of something I've harvested or killed. Is a healthier lifestyle in general that, like I said, not to go on a tangent, to the United States is definitely getting away from.
Yeah, totally. So I'm curious about you. Like, I actually have heard a few stories about you, Aaron, that you used to lift big weights and be kind of like a gym rat. Is that true? Were you, and also, like I mentioned, an MMA fighter, like, what's your history? How'd you progress from, wherever you were back in the day? It sounds like you were quite the fitness nerd into what you're doing now. What's your story?
Well, it's kind of weird. I'm actually a fat kid as far as, you know, the ecto, endo,
deep
and
down
mesomorphic.
Inside.
What's that?
Deep down inside, you're a fat kid.
My body type out of the three is definitely the kind that gains weight when you look at a cheeseburger. So I have to stay.
The apple shape, the endomorph apple shape.
Exactly. I'm an endomorph.
The Jonah Hill.
You're more of the Tarzan. I'm definitely not the guy that can eat whatever I want, right? Super fast metabolism. So kind of a fat kid. And then I joined the military. I was in the military for a few years and didn't learn really anything about nutrition in the military. Most people don't, but it did make me tougher. This is the very short version of obviously my life. When I got out of the military, I pretty much could eat anything I wanted when I was in the military. When I got out, I kept eating anything I wanted, but I wasn't running 6-8 miles a day. And dude, I got like fat. I gained probably 260, 40, 42 inch waist. And somewhere in that time of the 6 months is all it took to gain that much weight. I kind of had one of those clarity moments of what am I doing to myself, and just got super fit, stopped drinking soda, you know, basically just drink water, and started doing endurance races, whether it be mountain bike races or the standard, you know, race across whatever the Olympic Peninsula, where I was using a lot of my training with land navigation, mountaineering, climbing, mountain biking, kayaking, all those things combined, and started really getting into learning the healthy lifestyle that you live. And somewhere in the middle of that, I started dating a woman that, you know, more or less got me into this bodybuilding, powerlifting, strongman kick. Because normally I'm like 6'1 and 210. I got up to about 270. I could bench press over 500 pounds.
Jeez.
I got super strong. I couldn't walk up the side of a hill. But
what kind of training were you doing? Was it like bodybuilding or powerlifting? Or
a little bit of both. I mean, the only real difference between, at the root of it, a powerlifter and a bodybuilder is a diet. Is their diet? They obviously both have a very large amount of muscle. Not saying
the diet, and then also just the style of training, right? Like more compound multi joint lifts for the powerlifter, whereas the bodybuilder, you know, you bomb your chest on one day and then you bomb your biceps on another day. And it's generally a little bit more like body part focused.
From what I've seen, I agree with that 100%. From what I've seen is sometimes you can turn one into the other and vice versa relatively quickly because of the lifestyle, the hard work, the dedication, obviously the nutritional level. Now, not all powerlifters can be bodybuilders, and certainly not all bodybuilders can be powerlifters, but a lot of them cross over in some different ways. And I did both. I did a couple different bodybuilding competitions. I got more into powerlifting than anything because I just had this thing to be freakishly strong. I had a goal to bench press over 500 pounds. And I did. And then, you know, I had another goal where I wanted to, you know, the big three, I wanted to be go over 1,800 pounds with squat, deadlift, and bench press. And I was able to do that. And that was with that was suited up though. That was with a bench shirt and everything.
Right.
Cheating. But I did bench 500 pounds clean, no shirt, which was a big thing for me. But, you know, honest and upfront, I had some help from different supplementation that I probably shouldn't have been taking. My body is not meant to be.
You mean like hormones?
I was basically taking testosterone and anabolics at the same time. And
yeah,
growth hormones don't really do much for you for what I was wanting to do. I was straight up, without giving into a whole seminar on steroids or anabolics, but I was taking steroids basically just for strength. I didn't do it very long. It was definitely something I wish I could take back because I lost anything I gained. If I would have just eaten healthier and stayed in the gym, I probably would have, what I gained, I would have maintained. Where with steroids, when you get off, you lose all your naturally produced testosterone. So you end up losing.
Yeah. Did you find that you, because I've talked to a lot of people who have taken, you know, andro and some other forms of testosterone or steroidal precursors, and they found that it takes like 4 to 6 months to even start to get your libido back and be able to produce your own endogenous testosterone. Did you have a dip like that after you got off it?
Oh, dude, it can be much worse than that. You can figure, I'm not a doctor, but I played one on TV last night, but I can tell you 100% if you are on test 8 months, it will probably take you 8 months to get back to your natural, not just your libido, but also your mind is in a different place. And I'm not saying you go crazy. It's not as bad as what people make it out to be as far as, you know, super aggression. Depending on what you're taking, you can get aggressive, but it does take a while for your hormones to level back out. In my case, if you're okay with talking about this, I was taking 1,200 milligrams of enanthate per week. You usually, I'm not an expert, if you take 1,200 milligrams of enanthate or a testosterone, you want to take somewhere in the neighborhood of 500, 600, 700 milligrams of an anabolic. If you take too much test, you become very lethargic. If you take too much anabolics, you become very emotional. you can get.
Yeah, you get a lot of it converted into estrogens.
Yeah, right. You get gynecomastasia, which is obviously you'll develop women's breasts with
man boobs.
That happened to me. Yep, you get man boobs, and you have to have surgery to have them taken away. So anyway, taking what I was taking, my body, an endomorphic body with a lot of hard work, responds extremely well to that. So I put on 40 pounds in 4 or 5 months. A lot of that was water weight. But I was able to lift, 200-pound incline dumbbell bench, three sets of 10 to 12 with no spotter. Freakish strength that most people just would never have. I mean, there's one in a million people that are that strong naturally. Something yeah. I wish I hadn't done, but that is how I got to the size you've probably heard about, where I was just a freak of nature.
Yeah. You know what one of the crazy things about the testosterone and xanthate is even though it's banned by the World Anti-Doping Agency for sports and stuff like that, they've done studies and they found about half the people who take it don't actually get up to the urinary levels. What WADA tests for is your T to E ratio, like your testosterone yep. to epitestosterone ratio. And a ton of folks, seems like about half the population who takes testosterone and xanthate, they get all this muscular strength and power that you just talked about, but they actually don't test positive under the, at least the current WADA T to E ratio criteria. So there's a ton of people who dope with this stuff and get away with it for competition, and obviously if you're not competing, then there's no, real ethical concerns whatsoever, but it's interesting stuff. And then, like you say, there's always that bounce back where once you get off it, life kind of sucks for a while, right?
It does. I mean, in my case, like I don't know. I've never been on your podcast, how open you are about these things. So if I cross the line,
we're pretty open. We talk about shoving stuff up your butt and doing enemas so we can talk about testosterone.
Perfect. Okay. So when I was taking, test, I was also taking, like I said, an anabolic, which you want to be at a ratio about half of an anabolic to whenever you're taking a test. But I am a dummy and I wasn't paying attention, and I ended up taking more anabolics than I probably should have. And when you do that, your libido goes to nothing. I mean, basically, I didn't get like an erection for 3 months. Jeez. Which is very common for guys taking steroids. And
do you mean like not to get too explicit, but I mean, do you mean like at all? You just didn't get an erection, period? Or
not at all? Couldn't even punch my clown. Like nothing. Wow. No libido. It didn't work. Like, and here I am, you know what I mean? Like super just,
so
shredded.
You're not talking about just like lack of morning wood. You're talking about like complete impotence.
Oh yeah. Nothing. And jeez. I, in my case, like for me, I here I am, shredded, chicks all over in the gym, that scene, you can go to like meat wagon gyms, and didn't really matter, right? Nothing worked correctly. So that was from DECA was what did that. There's something, I don't know if you allow foul language on your podcast, you can edit it out, I guess, but they call it DECA, which is basically when it just gives you all total loss of not only libido, but also the function, correct? So nothing, right. And that happens frequently. Well, I was also taking another supplement that I took for about a month. It's very, very hard on your liver and your kidneys. And it gives you superhuman strength, superhuman sex drive, aggression. Everything you are internally makes it 10 times more, right? It's just insane.
Which one is that?
That is... oh, good Lord. Now you asked me, I forgot. It's, you can make it at your house. Can we come back to that when I can remember?
Yeah.
One of my buddies literally died. We had to revive him from it because his liver failed from taking, or his kidneys failed from taking it. But it just, my body did not handle it well. I had aggression problems when I took it. So the moral of the story is, don't take steroids illegally, because you're probably, one, going to do it wrong, and two, it may have long-term effects on your body. At this point with me, everything's fine. I haven't had any issues in 10 years. My joints on my elbows are a little bit sore from just, you're not built to curl 80 to 100-pound dumbbell curls.
Oh,
but
yeah.
Allow you to do that.
That's why a lot of like former steroid users, they're now turning to things like Well, there's this one newer form of supplement called peptides that they've shown in rats can help to heal connective tissue, literally as good as surgery. But then a lot of folks are doing like stem cell implants or stem cell injections, platelet-rich plasma injections, prolotherapy. There's this process called regenikine that some people are doing. But yeah, you find that the folks who have been on testosterone or some form of hormones, because it, like you say, it allows your body to be able to lift more weights than your joints would technically be able to handle under normal circumstances. And yeah, you get some wear and tear long term.
Oh yeah, for sure. And I've been pretty lucky, especially with, I don't even hardly lift legs now. I just, you know, for my training, I don't need to, but you know, my legs blew up to, you know, size wise, like I had 18 inch calves, and that, you know, calf muscle wise, yeah, it's really cool having calf muscles like I have, but it takes a lot of oxygen on the mountains. The more muscle you have, the more oxygen you need. So once I started getting back into backpack hunting, which I had always done, and this was just like one of those spots in my life where, I don't know, early life crisis. Well, it really affected backpack hunting. So then I started focusing on maintaining, you know, dense muscle mass, but losing everything I didn't need, which you really need a guy at your level to coach you along through that, because learning it on your own through trial and error is a pain in the butt, for one. And two, you're probably going to get it wrong, you know, if you do try it. So trenobolone was the name of that I was talking about.
Trenobolone.
Yeah. Very, very hard on your system. But either way, I started focusing on, I changed my workout routine completely. You know, I changed everything in my life, really. And in the middle of that, I did do a little bit of fighting. It's amazing. I don't ever talk about that. So obviously how that pops up has to be YouTube videos or something. It's not like I'm ashamed of it.
I think it was a bio of you somewhere on the internet.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah.
It may have been you, I know you've got a lot of articles on this pretty cool, outdoors forum called Rock Slide. And it may have been over on your Rock Slide bio that I saw that, but go ahead. So you were fighting.
Yeah. I fought a lot of, you know, illegal fights, to be honest with you. I was going through a divorce and I needed the money. I'm certainly no, you know, whatever, Royce Gracie, but I was always, as a kid, I liked to fight, and I still do today. I don't get into it as much for injury reasons, not to be a weenie, but when you make your living in the outdoor industry and you're constantly, something's pulled or torn and you can't go scouting, you can't backpack in to take photos for, you know, for Kafaru. So I stopped completely about 4 or 5 years ago, I guess, to where 7, 8 years ago, I was going at it full time, you know, frequently.
Yeah.
I don't, by no means am
I. What were you, were you a jiu-jitsu or were you doing striking or what was
jiu-jitsu is my thing. If the fight lasted more than 60 seconds on my feet, something had gone terribly wrong with the game plan. I do not have overly fast hands. I have powerful hands, but not very fast. I wrestled some in high school. I've taken jiu-jitsu and other variations and forms of that off and on my entire life. So it was, you know, something I like to do, just like anything. You know, some guys fly fish, some guys golf, some guys fight. I keep it as simple as that. Some people put way more into it than they should. But the way I was raised in a very small town in Oregon, fighting was normal. I mean, that's how you know, a guy walks into a bar, the first thing you think is, can I take that guy? I can take that guy. And I just was raised that way. Not saying it's the right way to be raised, but even now, especially with the military background and everything else I had done, you kind of assess the situation when you walk into a building, kind of look around and size everyone up. I've always just been that way. And I still am today.
Yeah. I hear what you're saying though, in terms of it, being risky as far as taking time off your life. Like I actually have a broken eye right now because I'm training for a fight in July and got my entire orbital bone fractured, right? Like if I blow my nose right now, my entire right eye will swell completely shut because there's a complete fracture between my nasal sinuses and the orbit of my eye. And for me, you know, just getting hit that way and that was just sparring. All of a sudden, it limits just about everything that you can do, right? Like I've had to cancel some of my little diving trips I was going to go on, and I've got to do only certain forms of working out. And yeah, like, full respect to these guys who can fight full time or be able to step into the ring at any point, or, you know, even go do some of these amateur fights. But it's hard to actually stay in shape for a fight and be able to, like you say, you know, live life and do some of these other pursuits that you want to do. So you wound up losing weight just by doing a lot of hiking and rucking?
Yeah, I mean, basically I did the CrossFit thing a little bit. I you walk your own path, right? You write your own book. I kind of learned my book on the way, learning, you know, I didn't really have anyone to help me, in the case, not to pimp you out, but in the case of someone like you, if I would have had the option to call someone that I knew and trusted, it would have simplified things, but I broke it down to a basic kind of an animalistic, I am on my feet, I am hunting, I need to train with a pack on my back. That's what I do. I also, obviously, you know, chicks dig big arms and a big chest. I want to maintain a decent look as much as I can. So I dropped, no more heavy weights, a lot higher reps, a lot more super setting. And I kind of did the, I'm backpacking for, I don't like to run. So I backpack for my cardio. I always have a pack on is what I'm getting at, between 25 and 80 pounds, depending upon what we're doing, and anywhere from 1 mile, you know, 37 to 45 degrees straight up the side of a mountain, or 6, 8, 10, 12 mile loops, whatever the case may be. I vary it just like it would be varied on the side of a mountain. And then in the gym, I do a lot of, I do abs, I do pull-ups, I do push-ups, light reps with weight, things like that. A lot of rope climbs, stuff that's basically, you know, I don't do any more really Olympic lifts anymore. There's nothing wrong with those. I just don't do those. I pretty much do a workout that I could do in my living room. I do go to, I belong to a couple gyms, but I've tried to simplify it to where no matter what I do, I can always stay fit no matter what. And gyms are great. I love going to the gym. I just want to make sure that I've got a pack on. I go up the stairs at Red Rocks. I'll knock out 40, 50 push-ups with my pack on. I'll knock out some abs. I'll stand back up, and then I hit the stairs again. And I've simplified it a lot compared to, in case of you, you know how geeked up you can be to be at a certain level. You have to, it's an art, in my opinion. Fitness can become not just looking good, but the knowledge base, the nutritional aspect of it. It is an art form to be able to take someone's body from a perspective of where you're at. You can take someone, inform them with dedication and hard work into who they want to be. And I didn't have someone to help me, so it took a lot longer and it was a lot more difficult, but you can do it. And I'm proof. I went from normal guy in the military to, you know, super fat guy to super skinny guy to really giant, huge dude to back to a normal, you know, above average fitness level, obviously, yeah. But with hard work, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah, I hear you. You know, I don't know if you knew this, but I wound up doing a huge amount of exercise-based fasting where I'd go out and do long endurance workouts without eating anything, like highly catabolic, because I used to be 210 pounds. And right now I weigh 175, but I was a bodybuilder back in college before I got into triathlon. And that was the way that I did it. That's not the healthy way to do it. If I could go back and do it over again, I would have done it more slowly. I would have taken like a lot of like, have you heard of amino acids before, like essential amino acids or branch chain amino acids?
Yeah. Take them every day.
Yeah. So they allow you to stay anabolic without dumping a bunch of calories into your body, but you don't get all the immune system issues and the joint issues from just doing like long fasted workouts. Cause there's thyroid, you know, implications and testosterone implications. But yeah, I wound up stripping a lot of weight off my own body and definitely did it, the wrong way. You know, I think that in an era now where there's like, you know, amino acids, like I mentioned, and exogenous ketones that you can take and all these cool things that allow you to maintain energy levels without getting all the hormonal bounce back of complete exercise based fasting. You can get, you know, light for the mountains, light for backpacking, you know, light for hunting, stuff like that without necessarily doing a lot of damage to your body. You know, we could probably do a whole podcast on that. But I actually, you know, I know that there's so many things we could talk about, Aaron, but I know that you've lived a pretty cool life out in the mountains and outdoors. So if you don't mind, I'd love to ask you a few questions about some of the stuff that you've done outdoors.
Yeah, definitely.
So outdoor photography and hunting and backpacking, what's the craziest situation you've ever found yourself in? Because I know you've been all over the place.
That's a tough one. And I've thought about this in case you ask me it. And I think one of the reasons it's so tough is when you're out there so long, the glass is very difficult to fill, where one man's life threatening, circumstance could be another one's fun time. So I don't really have an exact, super dangerous. We had a bear charge us, a grizzly once that, you could have trouble fitting a greased flaxseed through my ass with a hammer. It was definitely one of those hair-raising experiences. But I've been stuck in so many situations where, freezing cold, shivering, away from camp, what do you do type circumstances, where a lot of people, it was this huge thing, where now for me, it happens so often that those things just happen. It's not like you didn't prep enough, or it's not like you did something stupid. It's just when you live in the woods a couple hundred days a year, you're going to fall in a river from time to time. You're going to be forced to put your body through things that they're not used to. And I fell in a river a couple years ago solo and drifted down the river, I don't know, a long ways. And luckily enough, I unclipped my pack on the way, just obviously so I didn't die.
Mm-hmm.
Freezing cold, there was ice in the river. I had to go find my pack. And literally at that point, everything was pretty much wet, and I was forced to build a fire, strip down naked, built the heat wall that you'll see in movies sometimes and people don't know what they're doing, pulled out kind of a tarp to get around me to bounce the heat off, as well as the rock wall. And it was at a point where I was like, in the first 10 minutes, I thought, man, am I going to freeze to death? And the next 10 minutes, I'm like, ooh, I'm nice and toasty by this fire type of a thing.
So you're building a fire by a rock wall to use the rock wall as like a radiator?
Basically, rock walls, radiator on one side, my tarp is the radiator on the other, and it comes just a nice little happy home where the heat is radiating off everything towards your body, something you learn in survival school, and something you don't generally need to apply very often. That was one instance. I pissed out a kidney stone.
How'd you fall into a river in the first place?
Crossing a log.
Oh, okay.
River swells up in the springtime. And
right.
There's not going to be any ways to cross it. I picked the one log. I thought I could make it, and I didn't.
Yeah.
So, and obviously anytime, there's an accident, it's not an accident. There were several red flags that popped up before you're about to do something stupid. In this case, I probably should have just not crossed it, but I did. And one of the other times I pissed a kidney stone out like 6 miles in on a solo trip.
Oh, geez.
That one was pretty rough. Like I said, the glass is a lot harder for me to fill anymore. Nothing really raises the eyebrow for me.
Yeah. Have you ever heard of this guy named Wim Hof, who does like special breathing techniques to warm his body from the inside out?
So Brian talked to me. So every morning now I'm taking a 5-minute ice cold shower because of Wim Hof.
Nice. I teach my kids the Wim Hof breathing technique. We have a cold pool outside, like a cold pool for cold water immersion. And I take them out there and we do the, like the rapid where we'll do the deep, deep breathing in and out until the fingers get tingly, for anywhere from 2 to 5 minutes. And I'll have them get in the pool and stay in the pool for 5 to 10 minutes. And last week we were actually up river and Tara and my boys, we were beaver trapping in BC. And Taryn fell through the ice, and just instinctively, as soon as he fell through the ice and I pulled him out, he started doing this Wim Hof style breathing, just standing on the shore, trying to warm his body up, just that deep diaphragmatic breathing. So it was kind of cool to see it actually fleshed out in a semi survival situation. But I was just curious if you'd ever heard of Wim Hof, and it sounds like you actually have done some of his stuff.
Yep, wake right up in the morning because of him right now.
Nice. Cool. So, go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, I think that, and we talk about this, Brian and I do all the time, a lot of the things that we're talking about, and I try to, stay up on, kind of like math, survival is a perishable skill. Other than the will to live, that's ingrained in people, or it's not. A lot of these skills, obviously, I practice whether I need to or not now, which is why it's pretty hard for me to get too worried about any survival situation.
Yeah. So another kind of survival based topic I want to talk to you about, because I know you're a real expert on this. You work at Kifaru, and Kifaru makes a ton of stuff. I know you guys make everything from lightweight backpacking gear to tents to the same packs that I use. I've been using your packs for a year and a half now, especially for these train to hunt competitions that I do, and now just everywhere I go, you know, when I'm traveling to speak at a conference or to backpack, I'm wearing these big, you know, 7,000 plus cubic inch packs that you have. And one of the things is you can put a lot of weight in them. Obviously, you can put, you know, 100, 150 pounds in one of these packs. But I'm curious for folks listening in who want to know how to get as much weight as possible into a pack and be able to have it comfortably sit on their back, or at least as comfortably as you can have something like that sit on your back for as long a period of time. What are some of your top tips to get a pack to fit really well?
So, well, there's two things there. One's going to be loading the pack, and then obviously one is going to be, you know, the pack fitting correctly. So cover loading the pack first. That's the simplest. When you load the pack, you want your lightest weight material at the bottom of the pack. And roughly the first third of that is going to be lightweight for material from bottom going up. After that, the heaviest is going to go in the middle third, right up against your back, as close to your back as you possibly can. In the case of my hunting partner Colton and I last year, he had shot a bull. We both had about 180 pounds in our pack each, and believe it or not, for 8 miles.
That's heavy.
Now, it was bad. But physically, we went hunting 2 days later. We took, you know, we were able to do that because other than the normal soreness you're going to get, we didn't have the packs were fitted correctly. They were loaded correctly. So we didn't have the muscle knots you would get from an incorrect load, pulling on one shoulder, for simplification terms, pulling on one shoulder more than another, or giving you more pressure on one portion of your body or another. With loading the lightest in the middle or in the bottom and the heaviest in the middle, and then dispersing everything else throughout wherever you can fit it, and then equaling that load so the center of gravity keeps you basically able to stand vertically or as vertical as possible and also not tilted to the left or the right, you don't get trigger points or muscle knots that allows you to your body to not pull against one portion pulling against another, which is hugely vital. And people don't understand that your body is a tool and all tools need to be cared for longevity, or a car engine. If you misload a vehicle to where all the weight is on the right side and you drive that around for 800 miles, your tires are going to wear unevenly bald. Human body is no different. If you don't keep that even, distributed correctly left and right, top to bottom, front to back, you are going to cause not long-term damage. Well, I guess it could be long-term damage on your body, but very short-term damage to where you may not recover for a couple of weeks. Probably going to see a chiropractor. You're going to go need to see a massage therapist. And in some ways, it can cause long-term issues, especially if you're thrown off balance. So the load being distributed correctly is huge.
Now, what about so a lot of these nicer backpacks, right? They have a waist pad, but then they also have shoulder straps. How should you have the weight distributed as far as the difference between the waist strap and the shoulder pads and the shoulder straps when you're carrying a heavy weight?
Textbook answer is 65 to 70% on your waist and obviously the rest on your shoulders. In my case, I run almost 90% on my hips. My very strong hips doesn't bother me. I like I said, 10%, 15% is going to be on my shoulders. But you want the majority of that weight to be on your hip bones just because of how the human body works. Certain body parts fatigue faster than others. In the case of a human body, the shoulders fatigue much faster than your hips are going to or your legs. And that's the key to talking about pack fitting. There's all kinds of terms. Guys talk about load lifters, different types of waist belts, things like that. I'll kind of break them down, try to oversimplify it as much as I can. A load lifter is a strap attached to your shoulder straps that hooks from your shoulder strap to your top of your frame or somewhere on the frame. It doesn't technically lift anything other than your shoulder straps up off of your shoulders, which then transfers the weight down to your hip bones. Once that happens, it allows you to basically choose the amount of weight you want to carry on what part of your body. If the frame or the suspension that you have on your backpack, if it's a day pack, it doesn't matter, but on a load hauling pack, or if you're 5 to 7 day trip type of a pack, if the top of your frame isn't above your shoulders, when you pull on that load lifter, it's not really a load lifter, it's a load stabilizer. And so you need the top of your frame to be, you know, 2 or 3 inches above your shoulders. So that way, no matter what weight you get in there and the pack sags a little, when you pull on those load lifters, it's at an upward angle of roughly 15 to 35, 40 degrees.
Gotcha.
That transfers the shoulder straps upwards. And then now the weight is transferred down to your hip bones. Most people don't understand that in a backpack where you buy, I won't mention any brands or companies or whatever. When you buy a backpack, it may be extremely durable, but it won't be extremely comfortable because if you're, in your case, what are you, 6'4"?
I'm 6'3".
6'3". If you're 6'3", there is not a pack in REI, Sportsman's Warehouse, or Cabela's that is going to fit your body, which you probably experienced, meaning be able to carry the weight on your hips.
Right.
So it's vitally important to have a frame and suspension that are actually fitted correctly to each person.
Got it. Okay, cool. So it sounds like what it comes down to is you got to have your waist pad or the part, your the belt that goes around your waist. You have to have that about midsection of your hips so that load sits high enough up to where when you pull your load lifting straps, the actual top of the backpack is a little bit above your shoulders. And then you also need to ensure that, like you mentioned earlier, the lighter part of your load is distributed lower in that backpack with the heavier part in the middle so that you're not putting as much stress on your lumbar spine and you're more kind of distributing the weight like up around like your thoracic mid-spine area.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Well, you pretty much how you explained it is correct. And if you don't, I would say for lack of a better explanation, if any of those don't work or coincide with another, meaning let's say you have a really tall frame, but your waist belt sucks and it doesn't stay on your hip bones, vice versa, they all have to coincide with each other. They work as a team, basically. If there's one of those parts that's screwed up, they're not going to work. None of this will work, I guess, that we're talking about.
Okay, gotcha. Hey, and a quick question, not to put you on the spot too much, but your guys' packs are expensive. I mean, compared to like REI or Cabela's or something like that, I mean, you know, I think I paid north of like, you know, $600-700 for the pack. What is it about a pack that would make it that expensive? Like, what are you doing to a pack to actually cause it to cost that much?
Well, number one is we're 100% made in America and not made in America with Asian components, which is something that I've noticed in the industry today. They'll put that big made in America stamp, but it's all with Asian components. Our buckles, our webbing, all the thread, the needles were inspected. It is all made in America with obviously American labor in the building I'm sitting in right now. There's a price tag that goes along with that compared to exporting things to China where they make like $3 an hour or whatever it is. We pay a very good rate here, all made in America. American mil-spec components are generally more expensive than an Asian type of a component just because they're more durable, they last longer. There's a testing process through all of the different components we use from the government to meet a spec, which like throwing it out of a Blackhawk and different things, the military tests, our components meet those specs. That is the major reason for the price. American made here, all American components. The other thing after that really is you're paying for comfort. You're paying for the versatility of our packs. As you've noticed, we have almost too many options. It's confusing. A pack from 10 years ago will fit on a frame that we just introduced 6 months ago. We try to make sure, obviously we don't ever screw our customer base. We want to make sure you can use our pack for the rest of your life. So if you have a bag or a frame from 10 years ago, our current products will fit on that.
So you can just slide it off whatever frame is already fit to your body and put a different bag on, basically.
Exactly. With the frame system, we offer several different frames, but you can interchange the bag. So in the case of like with what I do, I have kind of a shed hunting photography scouting type bag. Obviously, I get them all free. I run the company. But if I want to go on a 14-day sheep hunt, I can pop my day hunt photography pack off and pop the 8,000 cubic inch bag, much like you have, and go on a sheep hunt with the same frame, and it's still custom fitted to me. Everything's precise. Nothing needs to be changed. I'm just putting a different bag on.
Gotcha. Okay.
You also have a lot of options, you know, as far as pockets to attach to where you can really cater that to each person. And there's a lot of R&D that goes into that. Is a lot of people know a lot of the reasons I'm in the field all the time, that you know, who I cut my teeth under, which is Patrick Smith is his name. He owns Kefaru. He started Mountain Smith in the 70s, the backpack company Mountain Smith. He's taught me so much about the industry, but he's ingrained several things into me. Obviously, comfort is important, things like that. But testing, it's mandatory for me in the position I'm in at Kefaru to be in the field a minimum of 100 nights a year for testing. He basically comes down and cracks me in the back of the head and yells at me when I'm not in the field enough. That's the kind of company we are, where we don't want to design it and test it in a building. We want to design it in the field, produce that design in a building, and then I head right back out like I'm leaving tomorrow to test a shelter.
Right.
I'm going to set it up for 5 days.
Which is why every time I try to get a hold of you, you're out in the mountains somewhere.
Pretty much, yeah, yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, you're always like, text me next week, Ben. I'm on some 14-day epic trip out in the middle of nowhere with satellite phone access only.
Right, the DeLorme inReach and the satellite phone. Yeah. Definitely buddy. Yeah.
Exactly. So that leads me to another question I want to ask you, Aaron. Oh, and by the way, for those of you listening in, not only am I going to put a link to everything Aaron and I talk about, from Trendblown supplementation to the Gritty Bowman podcast, to these train to hunt competitions, to everything else, if you go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/Aaron Snyder, and Aaron's name is spelled A-R-O-N Snyder, S-N-Y-D-E-R, bengreenfieldfitness.com/Aaron Snyder. But I'm also going to give you guys a special link over to the Kefaru website, which is where I get all my packs, all my gear, and there's going to be a discount that you guys get, a pretty fat discount on Kefaru stuff if you want to try out some of this stuff for yourself. But speaking of these packs, Aaron, for a multi-day pack, let's say you were going out in the field for let's say a week, what would be the crucial components found in your pack? Like, what would be the must-have items for you?
I would say I'm trying to pull up my gear list here right now. I've got it so I don't forget anything. So for me, one of the crucial things, Asteropin, which is a water purification system, which a lot of people are a little bit nervous about because it is a pin that just emits light out of it. But
it's called
it kills
Asteropin?
Asteropin. I carry a 32-ounce Nalgene bottle. I stop at a mud puddle or a creek. I fill it up. I put the pin in there. I swirl it around for 60 seconds. And it's purified. Now, I did very in-depth testing with Outdoor Life, where I was testing every purification system just about on the planet with water that had tested positive for Giardia to see what purified, how many times, the whole nine yards. And the Steropin was the only thing that constantly never had an issue. Right? Right. It always worked. So I carry a Steropin, and then I carry a backup water purification, which is Aquamira. It's drops. It's like 7 drops per quart.
Is that like iodine?
Kind of. Same principle. Iodine, obviously, you can pills or what iodine most people use. It doesn't have a bad taste to it. Iodine tastes like crap.
Gotcha.
Same principle, though. So I bring that as my backup or my lightweight. Sometimes I'll use Aqua Tabs. Same principle. It's a tablet. It just doesn't leave the crappy taste in the water.
Okay.
So that's one very vital thing for me. And then obviously, you know, depending upon the situation, optics are hugely important, but we're not talking about optics probably as much as survival.
Yeah, yeah. Like more the type of things that, you know, even if someone's not, say, hunting, what they'd need for survival.
So obviously the Steropin, my fire starting system, which I use trioxane, and, you know, I'm obviously doing it like a Native American where I'm building it with a flint and steel and a rock or whatever, but trioxane, you can buy at an Army surplus store. It's 89 cents a tablet. It'll light in water in the rain. It'll light anytime. I bring that with a flint and steel to start it. That's something that I pretty much have on me no matter what all the time. I also bring
The trioxane, those are those little cubes, right? They're like little like fuel cubes, like whitish type of cubes.
It's a purple. It's actually that's an Esbit cube you're talking about, which those work. This is a purplish cube.
Okay.
Burns at some insane rate. I've never not gotten a fire started in any situation.
Yeah, I'd never seen him before until I did this race called the Spartan Agoji in Vermont a few weeks ago, and it was 38 degrees below zero. One of the guys there had a bunch of these cubes with him, and he dropped one on a fire we were making, and I'd never seen something like that before, like a fire go up that fast in that cold of conditions. It was pretty amazing. So you have these fire starter cubes. What else?
Even though it's not survival, the Delorme InReach has been pretty vital, not only to my job, my marriage, and my relationship with my daughter and everything else, but the Delorme InReach is, for lack of very technical explanation, it is like a hotspot that uses satellites where you can text from your cell phone through that InReach to whoever you want. So you don't have to do like the, 70 style ABCD type texting. You text through your cell phone just like normal and go straight. And the text is sent through Iridium satellites, which has the most satellites of any satellite communication system is Iridium.
How much does something like that cost? One of those satellite phones?
Now that's not a satellite phone. I'll go into that one in a sec. This is just for texting.
So you can't call or anything, but you can pretty much text anybody on the face of the planet if you're out in the middle of nowhere.
Right. And that compared to a satellite phone, which I also have an Iridium satellite phone, a text always goes out because it only needs that signal for a second, where the satellite phone, I've had a couple survival situations with hikers I've run into that were having issues. It can be a 15-minute conversation could take literally 15 to 30 phone calls if you're in a bad position. Where a text message, it goes right through. Obviously, because you're talking on one's just sending text. So the Delorme InReach has been hugely important for me. It's been a great piece of kit, and I suggest really for everyone to get it. It's a couple $100 for the actual unit. It might be $229, I can't remember. And then you pay a monthly, they have several different plans, but you pay a monthly fee, or you can, I did that unlimited is what I've gotten, just paid it off for the year. But literally for day-to-day use, if a tower goes down, if you're out of service and you need to send, in the case with you, you're a super busy guy, you need to send your assistant a message, that InReach is basically Bluetooth to your phone. You can send it at any time.
That's pretty cool. That's pretty cool. But do you use a satellite phone as well, or is that Delorme InReach kind of like more of your the one that you'd recommend as a crucial one, with the satellite phone being an option?
I would say that the InReach, unless your wife is just, or husband is super pissed all the time and wants to talk to you, the InReach gives you not like one and done texts, meaning full conversation texts. It always works. It's less expensive. My satellite phone was $1,200 and it's $280 a minute after that. So it's more cost effective than a satellite phone. But if I'm traveling to Mexico, on a hunt, or if I'm going to the Northwest Territories or wherever, I'll have a satellite phone, and you can hook up several phones on the InReach. So somebody in the party will have an InReach so we can all use it, and someone in the party will have a sat phone. So it works well, but most people should probably rent a sat phone and buy an InReach, because you can use the InReach year round, where with a sat phone, it's probably a 7 to 10 day type of a deal. You can get them. I use Explorer Satellite Systems out of Florida is where I get my satellite phones from, and my minutes, stuff like that.
Okay, gotcha. So I know that we're coming up on time, but we've covered water, we've covered fire, we've covered the pack, obviously, we've covered a little bit of communication. Obviously, though, a big part of survival is also shelter. What do you carry in your pack as far as like a shelter system?
So for the most part, and I test all of them, Kafaru International makes several shelters. We make ultralight backpackable stoves, and then we make ultralight teepees and shelters. They're single wall, meaning there's no floor on them. But you can put a wood stove in them that weighs 1 pound, 9 ounces. For me, for solo use, the Kafaru Super Tarp and the Mega Tarp are definitely my go-to shelters. And I also carry an 18-inch Smith cylinder stove, which is a 1 pound, 9 ounce wood stove. People don't realize what a game changer in bad weather an ultralight stove can be, because you can dry out your gear, which is huge, and obviously stay warm. You can get it 80 degrees inside of a super tarp, which is 11 feet long and 6 feet wide in 15 minutes and maintain that heat by sticks that are laying outside. So
you're using sticks as your fuel on the stove, not gas.
Exactly. It's self-sustainable and man packable. So really? Literally you and I went in 10 miles. We have a stove, a heat source for a 15-day hunt where we can dry our stuff out every day. We can heat our food up. We can heat our bodies up every day. And honestly, like I say, the stove's 1 pound, 8 or 9 ounces, and the shelter's 1 pound. Add some stakes to that and everything else. You're pretty much tax, title, and license at 3 pounds for a shelter with a wood stove in it. It is a game changer, especially if you've experienced some crappy weather conditions.
And then you combine that with a tarp, and this is like it's not a tent. It's just like a tarp that you set up and that you can put that stove inside.
Exactly. And when I say tarp, it's a tarp that actually forms into a tent. So you can pitch it flat, or you can pitch it as an A-frame with some vertical wall space with the pullouts, and it turns into something just like a tent that weighs 1 pound, and you can put a stove inside of it. So if I need shade on the side of a mountain at 13,000 feet glassing up mountain goats, I'll pitch it flat to stay in the shade. If I need to, you know, bomb-proof, stake it straight to the ground, throw in the wood stove and weather the storm, which happened seriously in Colorado at 12,000 feet, 11.5, I'll drop down into tree line, pitch that thing. I'm happy as a camper. You know how fire is, man. Fire's like, that's Ranger television. You basically are sitting there and there's something about it that just ups the spirits tenfold when you have it. So
that's really cool. Okay, I'm taking notes furiously. And again, folks, if you wanna check out the notes, you can go to bengreenfieldfitness.com/AaronSnyder. Although I know that probably we've only tapped into a very, very small part of Aaron's brain when it comes to this stuff. Aaron, there is one other question I wanted to ask you, because I know you take a lot of really cool photography, and obviously a podcast is probably one of the crappiest venues in which to talk about photography because there's no visuals whatsoever. But tell me about the photo that you're most proud of, and if possible, where people could go to see that photo or a series of photos you've taken that you'd really like to showcase folks.
So my Instagram page is the easiest, obviously, which it's just Aaron_Snyder. And that has a lot of my, but low resolution, obviously it gets compressed. That has a lot of my cooler photos in it. The Gritty Bowman podcast that you mentioned before on his website, we're actually selling my prints on there. We had such a demand for them.
Oh, really?
Before I was just selling them to magazines, Backpacker, whoever asked for them. Occasionally I would sell one to somebody on Facebook that just asked me if they could have the raw edited image or the raw or edited image.
I'm looking at your Instagram posts or your Instagram page right now. Some of these are pretty epic, but I'm curious, is the picture of that tarp with the stove pipe-ish thing sticking out of it what you were just describing?
That's it right there. That's my happy home. And that particular trip, that we had three guys fall in a river, me being a weenie and not falling, I walked straight across. When we got to camp, everything was soaked. Literally the next morning, boots, gear, everything was dry because of those heated shelters, which, like I said, is a game changer. Not that it was life or death, but we got to go fishing for 3 days and be happy and not frozen and cold, where if I would have had a normal tent, yeah, I wouldn't have died, but I certainly wouldn't have had dry boots.
So what is the most amazing photo that you've ever taken, or the one that you're most proud of?
Man, that's difficult.
That comes to mind.
Three of them. Derek O'Driscoll on the side of a mountain. It's the cover of the Kefaru catalog.
All right.
Not just because of the photo, all the photo is epic, but 13,000 feet, the trip, we both lost 16 pounds, even consuming 3,600 calories a day, gain and losing 12,000 feet. That photo sums all that trip up in a split second for me looking at it, remembering the trip. The next one is a sheep. It's a Fannin sheep, a mix between a Dall and a stone sheep. The two hunters that harvested the sheep, the one hunter did. The two hunters are coming from behind it. I've got the sheep real close up in the photo and them as a shadow coming in the background. And then a shelter photo, a night shelter photo with the stars in the background lit up would be my third.
Do you have those on your Instagram page?
Yeah, they are. They'll pop out as you're scrolling down. I post too many photos. So
I'm scrolling through your page right now. These are amazing. Wow. I don't even know if I follow you on Instagram. I don't know why I wouldn't, because we've known each other for a while. I knew you're a photographer, but I gotta add you, man. This is a cool page. So folks, I'll link to Aaron's Instagram page. Very cool. Very cool, man. I love it. I like that you're out there not just surviving in the wilderness, not just hunting, but also collecting some amazing photo documentation of some very cool places I'm sure a lot of people have never been to. You live a cool life, man.
Cool story for sure.
Yeah. Well, folks, if you've got questions or you have comments about some of the things that Aaron and I talked about, if you want to hook up with Kifaru and try some of their stuff, if you want to leave a question for me or a question for Aaron, you can access the show notes over at bengreenfieldfitness.com/AaronSnyder. That's bengreenfieldfitness.com/AaronSnyder. Aaron is working on getting all of you a really cool discount on some of this Kifaru stuff too, like the tarps and the stoves and the packs and stuff that he talked about. So if you visit the show notes, I'll make sure that I have those in there for you as well. And Aaron, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing everything from how to get swole to how to lose your erections to how to get fit for the wilderness. We covered it all, man. Thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure. I'm anytime for sure.
Sweet. Yeah, we'll definitely have to have you back. I can tell already. But in the meantime, folks, this is Ben Greenfield and Aaron Snyder from BenGreenfieldFitness.com signing out. Have a healthy week.
You've been listening to the Ben Greenfield Fitness Podcast. Go to BenGreenfieldFitness.com for even more cutting-edge fitness and performance advice.